Now, the Mahayana, the second great phase, if you like, the central phase of the development of Buddhism in India, didn't quite so much change. The Hinayana conception of the three jewels didn't quite so much change it as, we may say, universalize it. The Mahayana tries to see the three jewels, the three refuges, in what we may call a universal perspective. They try to see, they try to understand to begin with what the three jewels were in principle, what they really meant, what they really involved, and they try to express that in the most universal manner possible. So in accordance with this general outlook, the Mahayana did not see the Buddha simply as a historical figure. They didn't see him just as someone who lived in India 2,500 years ago. For the Mahayana, the Buddha is a spiritual principle, if you like, a transcendental principle, the principle of enlightenment. But when we say principle, we mustn't misunderstand. It's not a question of anything abstract, anything conceptual. When we speak of the Buddha as being, for the Mahayana, a spiritual principle, we mean rather that for the Mahayana, the Buddha is, as it were, the living image of enlightenment, abstracted, as it were, prescinded from history, not having, in a sense, anything to do with history, existing, if you like, outside space and outside time. So this is what, for the Mahayana, the Buddha represents, this spiritual principle, this living embodiment of the ideal, if you like, of enlightenment itself, quite apart from the where and the when and the by whom of any particular attainment of enlightenment by anybody in history. So the Mahayana sees the Buddha, therefore, outside history, outside space, outside time, as endowed with all imaginable perfections, virtues, qualities, and so on. And they see him living, as it were, in a sort of spiritual world. Not living so much on the stage of history, but living even in a transcendental world, an ideal world, a world which is, as it were, the expression, in terms of a cosmos, of what the Buddha himself spiritually is. And in the Mahayana scriptures we get all sorts of very lavish and very beautiful descriptions of this ideal world, this Buddha world, as it were, this pure world in which the Buddha principle, the Buddha ideal, or if you like, the archetypal Buddha, lives. And it's usually described in terms of light and colour. The Mahayana scriptures don't go in so much for abstract descriptions, but rather for concrete ones. They speak even in terms of beautiful jeweled trees. They speak in terms of surfaces of lapis lazuli, traversed by golden cords. They speak of music, they speak of coloured lights, and so on, trying to give some sort of impression, to create some sort of impression, of what this ideal world is, in the midst of which the Buddha, the central figure of this ideal world, lives. So this is the Mahayana conception of the Buddha, or the Buddha principle, or the Buddha ideal. Something transcending history, something archetypal, something universal, something cosmic. And in the same way, for the Mahayana, the Dharma is not just the teaching of the historical Buddha, not just the words uttered in some obscure northeastern Indian dialect by Gautama or Shakyamuni, not just words which have been written down in books or scriptures. For the Mahayana, one may say, the Dharma is the great stream of spiritual influence that pours all the time from the eternal, the archetypal Buddha, the Buddha principle, or the Buddha ideal. And it's an influence that can be felt not only in northeastern India 2,500 years ago, but even here and now, at any time, in any place, if one is spiritually receptive. That can be written down in books at any time, made, therefore, into, as it were, new scriptures. This is the Mahayana conception of the Dharma, an everlasting spiritual influence, a stream of influence, if you like, not just something written down in books, not just a teaching. And in much the same way, for the Mahayana, the Sangha still consisting of two sections, though these two sections, we may say, are continuous. First of all, the Sangha consists for the Mahayana in what are called the Bodhisattvas, beings of advanced spirituality, those who dwell upon higher levels of being and consciousness, who can actually hear, at least sometimes, the words of the eternal Buddha, who are attuned, as it were, to the Dharma in the Mahayana sense, as a sort of effluence of the Buddha nature, sounding eternally on higher planes of existence. This is the Bodhisattva Sangha. And then, lower down, as it were, on this earth, as it were, there are those who look up to the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, those who aspire to be like them, those who contemplate them, those who are devoted to them, those who wish to be drawn up to the Bodhisattva level, who have that aspiration, whether they may be monks or lay people, whether they may be male or female, spiritually advanced or not spiritually advanced, so long as they have this upward aspiration, so long as they wish to be Bodhisattvas, to become Buddhas, to incorporate the Buddha principle, manifest the Buddha principle, they are also part and parcel of the Sangha in the Mahayana sense.